And you decided subsequently to have a sex life. And I remember when we talked in 1988, I said, well, goodness, considering that everyone had already branded you in this way, you went ahead and did it. You know, did you take into effect people's attitude to you? And you said, well, I think you said, well, I decided that I might as well be hanged as a sheep as a lamb, or something like that.
No, it wasn't really, not that I'd done it just for that reason. Yeah, it was more that it just happened the first time, and it seemed appropriate and right that it had happened. I certainly didn't sort of make up my mind in a cool, calculating way beforehand that this was how it was going to be, that the opportunity took me quite by surprise. But yes, I took advantage of it and was quite glad that I had done so, and I'm still quite glad that I did so.
In our interview in 1988, you referred to your sexual activity as being, you know, a process or a period of experimentation, which some people have found a sort of cold, calculating term. Some people find it disingenuous. Mm. Now, well, I wonder whether you would say more about what you meant.
I can't remember exactly what I meant, exactly, except that I certainly didn't mean that I approached the whole question in a cold, scientific spirit. I did once explain it to someone who had asked why I used this word, that I took experimental more in the sense that one uses it when one speaks of, say, experimental theatre. You just want to see how things will work out. But I must say, in the case of my first sexual experience and relationship, I didn't have those sort of thoughts. Someone, I suppose I can refer to Shabda without giving too much away. Someone did write in it some time ago, not so very long ago, that, I'm paraphrasing him, that it's a mistake to think of me as being cool and calculating. He thought of me himself as a very spontaneous person. And I think he got nearer to the truth than a lot of other people. And I think perhaps this is something that people may find it difficult to understand, especially now that I'm old, nearly 80, and I don't have the energy that I used to have by any means.
I mean, there is one of your sayings in, I think, Pieces of Fire. It's something, I'm much better than people think and much worse than people think.
Yes.
Does that feature here in this area?
I suppose in a way it does.
Yes.
Because some people like to divide one into almost the good Sangvakita and the bad Sangvakita, which can correspond to, well, the good Sangvakita, let us say, is the Sangvakita 1, and the bad Sangvakita is Sangvakita 2. So we want the good Sangvakita. That's the one that really matters. We'll try to ignore or get rid of the bad Sangvakita.
But do you think for you there was a, you know, an impetus to break out of being trapped by people's expectations of the good Sangharakshita? Do you think that was part of it?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I was just, as it were, being myself.
Sure.
I was doing it for my own sake, and not to break down other people's, you know, presuppositions about me.
But except as some people, as you know would point out, you were, if only occasionally, still wearing robes.
Yes.
How did you deal with that? What did you
For me, it wasn't a problem. For me, it wasn't a problem. I knew quite well, orthodox Buddhist would think. I knew that quite well. It wasn't that I was in ignorance of that. But I wanted to make the point that I was neither a monk nor a layman. So if I had discarded my robes, everyone would have thought I was a layman. And if I continued to wear them and continued to be celibate, everybody would have thought, I was a monk. I didn't want to be either. So I had to be some sort of hybrid for the time being, until the principle that I was concerned with was established, that the order was an order not of monks or of lay people. It was something quite different.
Sure. You were older than most of us and a bigger person, as I've said, than most of us. And you were the head of the order, the founder of the movement. you must have taken into account or thought about the effect on the Sangha of the fact that it had a leader who was sexually active and in a series of relationships. Did that concern you? What effect that
might
be having?
Not really, because I saw that other people were in sexual relationships and sometimes having a whole series of them. So that sort of thing, certainly in the circle in which we were all moving, was very, very general. It was nothing very surprising. And of course now perhaps people have settled down, the more elderly, and they're looking back on their youth in some cases and back on me, and perhaps in some ways re-evaluating things in accordance perhaps with, in some cases, a more conventional standard. I think you can have, there are two models. In America they seem to be developing the model of the teacher as someone analogous, you know, to a doctor or a therapist. So they've got to be very clearly defined.
Boundaries.
Boundaries, yeah. But then the other model is the relationship between the student and the disciple, the teacher and the disciple, being, so to speak, completely open. Anything might go. This, of course, was Trungpa's attitude.
Mm.
I think I was a little bit, as it were, in between these two models, but perhaps with more of an inclination towards the second one I've mentioned, the more free and the more open. I certainly am not happy about Buddhist teachers, you know, settling down into being something comparable to a doctor or a therapist, and having those sort of professional boundaries which are agreed upon and enforced and all that sort of thing. I think that's quite a betrayal of the Dharma if they're Buddhist teachers. I wouldn't say that anything goes. I wouldn't, you know, go so far as Trungpa went in some cases. Well, I certainly go a bit further, or did in those days, some of the more timid, sort of semi-professional teachers of the Dharma.
One outcome of your sexual orientation and your decision to engage in sexual activity has been that I think there are some women who consider that your view of women and your ability to relate to women is in some way affected, that you have a natural tendency to favour men, to idealise men in a way that you don't have with women.
I find that rather laughable. Due to my activities in the course of the last so many years dealing with people, I don't have the slightest tendency to idealize men, even those who have been quite close to me. I think I see them quite clearly. And of course I don't idealize women either. I see women as human beings and treat them as such, just as I see men as human beings and treat them as such. And I don't think that any woman who has ever come to see me individually can complain that I didn't listen to her or discuss things with her in an open and sympathetic manner.
But maybe that comes back to that issue of sometimes a seeming discrepancy between your public position and a more intimate private position, insofar as, you know, there are statements that people find in seminars that you've given.
My public position is the Buddhist tradition. Let people read the Pali scriptures.
But when somebody stumbles, for example, on a sentence or a little conversation on a seminar where, you know, it could be quite easy to think that women are being, you know, made fun of in some way or blasphemed against. What advice do you have to a woman today who is to stumble on one of those sections of a seminar? How should she take it? How should she?
I think she should see my teaching and the Buddha's teaching and the FWBO and my relations with people, including women as a whole, and not attach so much importance to one passing remark.